This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, Vice President of Security Technology at Synopsys and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Synopsys and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.synopsys.com/silverbullet. This is the 147th in a series of monthly interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have today with me Kathleen Fisher. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Kathleen Fisher is a professor and chair of the Tufts Department of Computer Science. Previously, Dr. Fisher was a program manager at DARPA, where she started and managed Hackams and PAML. She also has been a faculty member at Stanford and a principal member of the technical staff at AT&T Labs Research. Kathleen's research focuses on advancing the theory and practice of programming languages. Recently, she's been exploring synergies between machine learning and programming languages with an emphasis on building more secure systems. Dr. Fisher is an ACM Fellow. She's a recipient of the SigPlan Distinguished Service Award, Vice Chair of DARPA's ISAT Study Group, and a trustee at Harvey Mudd College. Kathleen holds a BSc in math and computer science and a PhD in computer science from Stanford. She lives with her husband in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Her daughter, Elaine, is in grad school. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So you've been doing scientific research for many, many years. I'm interested in your view of research of the DARPA variety in science land versus, quote, research of the black hat DEFCON variety. So what are your thoughts on all that?
I think that DARPA does really interesting project-focused research. So DARPA's charter is to explore and find potential for surprise, right? We don't want to be taken by surprise, and we'd like to be able to take our adversaries by surprise. So DARPA spends a lot of energy thinking about where that potential for surprise might be in a bottom-up organizational structure. So program managers are hired for their potential to find interesting surprise and then explore the space around that potential surprise. So unlike, say, the National Science Foundation, whose mission is to just advance the state of knowledge, DARPA is really about that surprise and taking technical risk off the table in a project-focused way. So DARPA identifies some problem area that is important for national security where the state of technology is shifting, and so the landscape might be radically different in a few years, and dives in to explore what's possible, what's not possible, and what does it take to get there.
Mm-hmm. So DARPA is interesting in science land in its own right, and differs from sort of, you might say, normal scientific research a little bit because it's driven by a mission.
It's driven by a mission, right? So I think both NSF and DARPA's focus are important and complementary, right? NSF is about advancing science for the sake of science, which is fantastic and really important. Mm-hmm. DARPA is about solving particular problems, and in the process, almost always advances the state of knowledge as well, because if we already knew how to do everything, it probably wouldn't be on that frontier of surprise that DARPA is focused on.
So now let's talk about the, quote, research that's done by, quote, researchers at Black Hat and DEFCON, you know, the hacker people. Contrast that to kind of science research. This is a thing that I try to do with both sides of the debate, you know, the divide. Maybe to spur your thinking, you know, science based on literature knows where it came from and has sort of an agenda for moving forward. And some of the hacking research is very much hands-on, uses real systems, but, you know, is often not quite as disciplined. So I'm interested in your view of how they fit together.
Both are actually really valuable. So like my experience at DARPA, one of the things you have to do to convince DARPA to invest money in an area is show that there are problems. And the kind of experiences that come out of Black Hat show examples where, oh, right, that system, which we really would like to be secure, isn't actually at all secure, and here's how some really clever individual was able to go off and figure out how to hack into it. Those kind of, you know, one-off experiments that require really deep expertise and knowledge are really helpful data points for spurring, oh, we need to go be more systematic about how we build security into these systems. So in some sense, the two kinds of research can be really complementary. Mm-hmm. The sort of practical in the weeds of the reality of today that often gets published at Black Hat is really helpful for showing where there are big weaknesses and the longer range, okay, what are we going to do systematically to raise the standard so that it's harder to find those kinds of vulnerabilities is something that is better done in a more systematic, literature-based kind of approach.
Yeah, that makes sense. Slightly different. So slightly different topic. I grew up on Scheme and wrote my ridiculous thesis code in Scheme. So what's your favorite programming language? I know you're a hugely active programming languages person.
My favorite programming language. I'm kind of torn. I like functional programming languages a lot. I like the connections with mathematics and the really crisp, clean way you can specify certain kinds of functions that way. ML is a language that I grew up with that I really like. I like the pattern matching and the recursive functions, the way of structuring your code that way. Mm-hmm. Not so good for user interfaces, but most of the code that I have to do isn't user interface focused.
Right.
But ML is kind of not super actively being developed anymore, and most of the action on the programming language research side is now in a language called Haskell, which also has some adoption in the commercial world. I like a lot of the features of Haskell. I like how it's open and exploring the frontier. It's based on what's called lazy evaluation, which means that the order in which parts of a program are evaluated is determined by when they're actually needed to compute an answer for the user.
Yep.
And so it's really hard to predict when things are going to be executed, which makes it really hard to predict how much memory or time it's going to take, which is a pretty significant downside. So I'm kind of conflicted between those two, ML and Haskell.
Uh-huh. How about MOBI? Tell us about MOBI.
So MOBI is a language that John Ruppe and I worked on just after I graduated from my PhD, looking at combining the strengths of object-oriented and functional programming into one system using structural subtyping in addition to declared subtyping. So structural subtyping, you just look at the types and see if, you know, one type has everything that the other type needs to in order to be able to for the one objects of the one to pretend to be objects of the other,
mm-hmm.
versus sort of nominal subtyping or what you see. So like interfaces in Java have structural subtyping versus classes in Java have declared or nominal subtyping.
Mm-hmm.
So MOBI was working on having both of those existing in a same framework. So Scala is probably the most similar language now to what the work that John and I did on MOBI.
Yeah, interesting. Oh, I miss my programming languages days. They were long, long ago.
Yeah, I really like programming languages. One of the things I like about the field is that you can do theoretical work and design work and implementation work and experimental work and applications work all within the same project, because you can develop a language and explore its theory and design what it looks like and then build applications and measure how it's doing, so you don't get stuck in only proving theorems or only writing code or only doing measurements. You get to do all of them together in a coherent way.
Yeah, that's cool. So like me, I think you believe we can build systems that are more secure if we really work on it.
And yeah, if we wanted to, we could, for sure.
And you worked on Hackams at DARPA, and that's sort of demonstrated one way to go about this. So what do you think is holding us back from building systems that are secure?
What is holding us back? So, I mean, in the one hand, it's a really hard problem, right? Security, to get it right, you have to get so many things right at the same time. An attacker just has to find one way where you screwed up. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to get all those things right. Hackams was really focused on vulnerabilities that come about through errors in the implementation, so bugs in coding. And the goal was to use mathematical-based techniques, formal methods, to produce code that comes along with a proof of correctness. So if you can prove that correctness, then it doesn't have memory safety kinds of vulnerabilities, for example. And we showed that we could do that not for 100 million lines of code, but for smaller systems, but still had security relevance. So what's holding us back? You know, one is the problem seems so daunting when you get to the 100 million line code that it sort of says, well, like, just don't bother at all. And I think that's not the right response. Even if we can't secure all of 100 million lines of code, it doesn't mean we can't secure reasonably pieces of that have disproportionate effect on the overall security of the system. So part of it is it's a really hard problem. Another part is we don't have proper accounting. The people who make the security bugs and who cause the problems don't pay the bill typically for cleaning it up.
Yep.
And so there's incentives are misaligned. It's really hard to count the actual costs of the security cleanup. So it's hard to know kind of how much money there is spent on this problem. The sort of the thought experiment is, what if you had all that money and you distributed it to the people who are writing the software and told them you must use this money to fix these bugs? How much better would software be in that case?
Mm-hmm.
So I think if our incentives were more properly aligned, we would have better quality software. I think also the downstream costs to consumers are probably going to go higher as more and more security vulnerabilities happen and more information gets stolen, and that might cause consumers to decide, maybe I'm willing to wait another 3 months for my new app update in exchange for having that code be written to a little bit higher quality. So that's a third impediment, is the sort of demand for new features instantaneously. In the competitive market, that means companies are much more interested in delivering those new features as fast as possible and not worrying so much about what the security consequences of those features might be down the road.
Absolutely. And I think you're right about the economic incentives being misaligned. One way to tie those together is to have maintenance budget be computed as part of a total cost of software creation,
so that
when people hit their date, they also have to estimate what it's going to cost to do maintenance over the next year or two. And if they're wrong, they get dinged. And if they're right, they get a bonus. And, you know, Phil Venables did that at Goldman a zillion years ago, and that worked pretty well.
Right. I mean, I think one of the challenges with that is the sort of uncertainty of when a particular, you know, latent exploit will be triggered. You know, you could have a system that has a huge vulnerability in it that nobody's found or exploited for a really long time, and so the cost has been essentially zero, and maybe it will never be exploited, so the cost is always zero.
Right.
Versus, you know, something's been sort of pottering along just fine for, you know, years, and all of a sudden there's a really clever hacker who figures out how to exploit it, and now the cost is astronomical. Like, how do you build that into a model to estimate what that maintenance budget should be? Like, it's like the probability of finding it versus the damage if you find it, that probability is super hard to calculate, and that makes it really hard to reason about. I do think, you know, insurance companies are starting to offer insurance for this kind of thing, so they're starting to develop models that they're confident enough in that they can sell products based on. But I think that we're a long way from a mature insurance model that might help align those incentives.
I agree with that. Let's talk about tech transfer a little bit. So in my experience, it takes about a decade, a huge bucket of money, and some very passionate advocate to transfer tech from the lab to the commercial world. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that that's maybe even optimistic. It depends on how aggressive the tech change is. So like the tech that was developed in Hackham's, the formal methods-based techniques, pretty huge divergence from normal software development practices. So it probably will take more time than that, unfortunately, particularly for technology that isn't immediately tied to a financial return on investment. Like, if you have new tech that investors can see, like, wow, as soon as we get this deployed, we're going to get a 10 times return on investment, that goes out very quickly.
Yeah.
But tech that is, you know, yeah, if you use us, you possibly won't have to spend $1 billion down the road, a much less compelling sell, and so it takes a lot longer. And you need to get the kind of external motivators to say, like, oh, this is why I need to go ahead and adopt this technology. And that's part of what we were trying to do with Hackham's. So in the program, we had researchers build tools and techniques to allow them to build software for vehicles that red teams had much harder time breaking into, right? Mm. The quadcopter the red team couldn't break into with 6 weeks of full knowledge of the system. So that quadcopter, which was an open source quadcopter you could buy from Amazon, the technologies got ported to Boeing's Unmanned Little Bird, where Boeing researchers, not formal method researchers, but Boeing aviation engineers, took those tools and techniques and applied them to the Unmanned Little Bird. And then the red team tested that system and, again, was not able to break in or disrupt the operation of the helicopter. Even having full access to the system and full knowledge of the system, they were so confident that they allowed the red team to attack the helicopter while it was in flight.
Yeah, I heard that. And they also gave them the code for the camera.
Right, exactly. They had root access to the partition for the camera. They had all of the knowledge, and all they could do was crash the partition that was running the camera. And then the master partition noticed that the camera partition was down and restarted it. So the effect was the camera was down for like a minute, and that was it, right?
Yeah.
So that shows transfer from the formal methods researchers to the aviation engineers. And then in phase three, the Ray Richards, who was the program manager then, spent a lot of time working with transition partners in the military who have different motivations in the commercial sector to want to make sure that their platforms are under their own control and not an adversary's control.
Mm-hmm.
Demonstrating successful transition to a whole bunch of different kinds of military systems, you know, big trucks and various kinds of quadcopters and various kinds of space technology, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The long-term goal there is to hope that Pentagon procurement officers understand that this technology is possible. And so when they're writing their request for proposals, they put in requirements about you must, you know, demonstrate that this part of the system has these properties in a machine-checked way.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, when the companies that normally bid for those on those calls come and say, "Ha, that's ridiculous. We can't. No one can do that. You have to take that out. No one will be able to respond."
You can say,
the procurement officer can say, "Like, well, these, you know, grad students were able to do it. Why, you know, why can't your highly paid engineers replicate what a few grad students did?" And so, like, to keep those clauses in the calls, and then have the company say, "Like, well, I want to get that contract, so I'm going to go hire some people and build some tools and figure out how to do this stuff." And then, you know, build up their capacity, successfully bid, successfully deliver product, and then create a virtuous cycle to the point where the companies have sufficient technology expertise that they can then start saying, well, you know, in addition to providing this for military customers, maybe they're medical device customers. Maybe
yep.
we don't want to have insulin pumps and pacemakers vulnerable to remote hacking. We could, and you know, those are also systems where these kinds of techniques are really appropriate because the code bases are relatively small and the cost for vulnerability is super, super high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
that's the dream. Like, yeah. Who knows what, you know, what will actually happen? But
it all happens. It just takes longer than we want it to. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, make sure to check out my other projects on GaryMcGraw.com. There you can find writings, videos, and even original music. What's the Research Valley of Death, and how do we overcome it? And what did you do as a PM about that?
Yeah, so part of what we did was we structured the program so that there were paired systems. There was a research platform that everybody had full access to. There were no ITAR restrictions. There were no classification restrictions. Everybody had full access.
Mm-hmm.
So that allowed kind of maximal free-flowing of ideas. But then there was a paired sister system that was proprietary. So like the unmanned little bird, for example, proprietary to Boeing. And really only the Boeing engineers had access to that system. And so to deliver the stage 2 and stage 3 results for DARPA, the Boeing engineers had to be able to use the tools and techniques on the unmanned little bird platform.
So
the
knowledge had to go. That made a very nice threshold, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Had to go from the heads of the researchers in the universities into the heads of the very smart and very well trained but not formal methods experts at the company, so that they had to apply the tools and techniques. So that's, you know, stage one. So I'd say there are people at Rockwell Collins, and there are people at Boeing and other companies who had to learn how to do that on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And now the hope is that that's enough of a beachhead to get more uptake in those companies. I mean, I think the long-term value proposition is reasonably clear, particularly for companies that supply sensitive systems, that they really don't want to be introducing vulnerabilities for their like long-term reputation and viability.
Mm-hmm.
But it, you know, there aren't a huge number of formal methods researchers, so tools are often in kind of somewhere between alpha and beta stage, and documentation is kind of poor.
Researchware is what we used to call it.
Yeah, researchware, exactly. So you still have all of those challenges. But I think the sort of proof of concept that Hackam's represented, saying like, no, really, you can secure something as large as a autonomous helicopter big enough to fly two people, to the state where, you know, professional red team can't break in 6 weeks despite having full access, full knowledge of the system and root access to a partition on the system. They didn't have to like get into it. They were given that access.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, pretty impressive, and hopefully silences some of those doubts that say, oh, no, this is not possible. You know, why bother?
Yeah, what a cool story. So in addition to Hackam's, you also worked on PAML at DARPA. What progress has been made in the last 25 years in machine learning? Or are we just basically taking the stuff that we did 25 years ago and putting it on way better computers?
Well, I do think a lot of the success of neural nets is we're putting it on way better computers.
Me too. I'm glad you agree with that. I was a little worried about the answer to this one.
actually, in some sense, parts of machine learning or AI and parts of formal methods share some characteristics, and that both of them turn out at least to have a core component that is the searching of vast space.
Yep.
And so when you have computers that have a lot of memory and a lot of cycles, you can search much, much bigger spaces than you could 50 years ago. So I think a lot of the initial failures of AI and formal methods were not because the approaches were wrong, but because computers weren't fast enough yet.
Absolutely agree.
And
yep.
We're kind of at a, I don't know, golden period right now for both machine learning and AI and formal methods, and that the computers are powerful enough that we can do really interesting things now that we couldn't before.
Yeah, I saw that you recently published something in genetic algorithms, and that's another technology that is just ripe for the picking right now, I think.
Yeah, we had fun with that. That's a project with an undergrad at Tufts. Like I was talking to you earlier about Haskell and how it has lazy evaluation and how that means it's really hard to figure out when exactly things are going to execute, and that means that you can have a lot of unpredictability about the memory and time resources required for your program. Bang annotations are a way of having the programmer tell the compiler, like, I don't care what your laziness evaluation says, execute this now.
Right.
The downside with that is, so it's really hard to figure out where to put them, actually, to have performance improvements. It's something that sort of expert Haskell programmers know how to do, but everyday, you know, Jane Doe, not so good at. And so this program was using, as you said, genetic algorithms to come up with suggestions for good places to put in those bang annotations. And we saw pretty significant performance improvements. I just have a paper submitted now, actually, that's doing the... So the downside of that is it introduced a lot of bangs.
Yeah,
and each bang, you kind of have to reason about, to think about, well, is this safe or not?
Yeah.
So the follow-on paper that's under review right now is figuring out how to minimize the number of bangs. So it maintains most of the performance and reduces the number of bangs inferred by about 90%.
Wow, really cool. So how do probabilistic programming languages work?
Yeah, so probabilistic programming languages are... You build a model of the system that you're interested in as a program, and one of the things you can do is say, like, well, I don't know what X is exactly, but I think it's drawn from this kind of a distribution. And then you can just use X as a normal value. And then you can run the program forward, and when it gets to that X, it says, oh, okay, X is drawn from, say, a normal distribution mm-hmm. with these parameters. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say X is 10 for this run.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to the end, and you get the answer out. So running it forward isn't actually the interesting direction. The interesting direction is you give it a bunch of data, and you say, like, given that I've observed all of this data, what's the most likely value for X?
Mm.
So you kind of run it backwards mm-hmm. to get those answers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a nice way of raising the level of abstraction of machine learning problems. So, like, most machine learning these days is focused very much on sort of matrices of numbers, where you have a model, but it's very, very weak model. So you don't really understand how the pieces fit together.
Right.
Like, this is the explainable AI problem, right?
Yep.
You're like, you know, why is that a cat? 0.23. Like, 0.23 means nothing to me. Like, tell me why it's a cat, right? And being able to explain, well, it's a cat because it has whiskers and it has ears and it has fur and it's about this size, right? Those are kind of things that you might put in a model.
Yep.
And so the probabilistic programming languages are designed to make it easy for you to build the model and then dump in the data and figure out, like, what part of the space of models that the probabilistic program represents is the most likely. There's actually some fair controversy in the machine learning community about how useful models are. There's definitely a school that thinks models are pernicious because they bias you in favor of your prejudices that have been embodied in the model instead of allowing you to be freely guided by just the data. My personal assessment is that right now, because there's sort of so much low-hanging fruit we can do with really very simple or almost non-existent models, but as that low-hanging fruit goes away, we're going to need to encode higher-level understanding of what's going on to be maximally effective.
Yeah. My very first journal publication was about using CBR to explain genetic algorithm results in the schema theorem. Like, that was, you know, 30 years ago or something. The probabilistic programming reminds me just a smidge of simulated annealing for some reason, because of the pushback or the backflow or something like that. That's
I think that they're related.
So let's tell me what role you think programming languages play in software security, and then we'll sort of put that in bed.
Well, the language that you use has a huge impact on what you're able to do effectively and efficiently, and kind of what you leave lying on the lying around. So, like, C is very good at expressing low-level. There's no abstraction barrier. It gives you direct access to the machine, which is very effective and important for when you're programming low-level machine code. But it's notoriously difficult for people to not make mistakes with buffers and overflow.
Something about, like, you know, power saws and kindergartners.
Something like that. And so, like, there's been a bunch of work on how can you make a better C, something that still gives you access, but has a lot more seat belts and suspenders on it too, so you can get efficiency, but you're less likely to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Like Rust is an example of that. There's in general the sort of overhead, the cognitive overhead of using the fancier type systems has not yet proven worthwhile. Although I think that goes back to our earlier conversation about we're not appropriately counting for the cost of the mm-hmm. security vulnerabilities,
mm-hmm.
and so we're not appropriately rewarding the richer sets of languages that make it easier. I mean, I think, you know, also different languages have different targets, right? So, like, C is very good at the low-level descriptions, but it's not so good for higher-level programming. An example would be, like, writing a parser, right? So parsers are all over the place because everywhere we get data from a wire, we have to convert it into a representation that's suitable for the program that's going to use that data. And, you know, people who write parsers in C should just stop writing parsers in C, right? The number of vulnerabilities that come about because somebody wrote a parser in C, it's really high, actually.
Right.
And so part of what you need to do with languages is choose the right language for the task that you're working on. When I was in grad school, I remember, you know, a fellow grad student asking me about what my research was, and I was like, oh, I said, you know, programming language. And he gave me this look of disbelief, like, why would you ever be doing research in programming languages? We have C++. What more could you possibly want?
Oh, good
want?
Lord, one of those.
Yes. Well, I mean, this was when, you know, you basically had to write code in the language of the operating system that you were running on because everything ran on a single machine in a monolithic way. And
right.
if you weren't in that language, you paid a huge performance cost, and performance was everything.
Yep.
Now, with distributed computation and the web, now almost every application is written in a whole smorgasbord of different languages. And, you know, if you're already, like, passing your messages back across a network, it really doesn't matter if one system is running in one language and the other system is running in a different language, because the overhead of changing from one language representation to the other doesn't even measure on the scale when you mm-hmm. talk about, yeah, but you're sending a packet across the network and you have to serialize and deserialize it anyway.
Yeah, or we're waiting for the monkey to move the mouse.
Oh, we're making, yeah, exactly. So there's a lot more flexibility these days. There's much more open ecosystem. So, like, students now are not adverse to learning many languages because they know they're going to have to learn many languages for no matter what they end up doing. So
mm-hmm.
that's a really exciting development in the last 15, 20 years in programming languages, going from a sort of you will write in C++ to, you know, what's the language that we're using here for this purpose and why are we using that? And that opens up the ability to use languages that are better, which have better security properties
mm-hmm.
for the particular task. So, like, don't write your parsers in C. Write your low-level device driver in C and then use tools to prove that it always terminates. So one of the interesting things about C, actually, on a slight digression, is that it's actually easier to prove properties of C than to prove properties of higher-level languages often, because the higher-level languages depend upon garbage collector
right.
and things that are written in C. So you have to be able to prove C code correct before you can prove Java code correct.
Yep. I remember that from the very early Java days. We were actually looking at the virtual machine, which was, of course, written in C.
Yep.
So last topic. You've been sure. active in CRA's Committee on the Status of Women, and
yes.
obviously you are a very accomplished woman in technology. So the question's kind of dumb but important. What role can men like me play in creating a welcoming environment for women in tech?
Oh, right. Well, so sincerely asking questions like that is a really good start. I think, you know, arguments that say, you know, women just aren't as good or women for some reason aren't interested are not helpful. I think that we don't have a way of systematically, like, we can't take an 18-year-old woman who hasn't been subject to 18 years of culture saying you shouldn't go into computer science
mm-hmm.
And have a sort of experiment that says, well, since that woman didn't decide to go into computer science, it's because she wasn't good enough or because she didn't want to. It's like, well, how do you can't erase that first 18 years.
Exactly.
So having majority populations acknowledge and recognize that and offer to partner, you know, to say that. So it's not always the women who are saying, like, wait a minute, like, that's, you don't have any scientific basis for making that claim. Like, and when you say you have a scientific basis for making that claim, you know, you're not being helpful, because if you think about it, you can't possibly have a scientific basis for making that claim, because we don't have the ability to undo those 18 years of culture influencing our young women. So, you know, basically standing up and saying, like, I care about diversity and inclusion. I care about having an open door. Anybody who's interested can come in, and we'll figure out how to get the skills and training necessary for that, for, you know, anyone who wants to succeed is really very helpful.
Cool. Last question, and it's a flyer. So I recently read this book called Luna Wolf Moon at the Beach, which is kind of, it's really new sci-fi. So I'm wondering, I know you read some sci-fi. What's the best sci-fi book that you've read recently?
It's a hard question. I mean, probably the best one I've read recently is Patrick Rothfuss, The Kingkiller Chronicles. I just recently reread books one and book two, and I'm desperately waiting for book three to come out. One of the things I really like about those books is how well, I mean, I'm sort of, book three has been waiting for a really long time.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons why it's sort of worth waiting for is how carefully crafted the books are. So, like, if you go back and read book one, you see all of these things that were foreshadowing or giving you more information about things that you knew nothing about until you read book two.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, the how tightly coupled everything is gives a lot of encouragement and excitement about what's going to happen in book three. And there's a lot of meat there to like dig in, like what's really going on. And you kind of, the story's happening at one level, but there are multiple other levels happening at the same time. And as when you study it, you can see what's going on. And so there's lots of motivation to speculate and talk about it and figure out what you think's happening. And there's lots of online forums of people talking about this and discovering clues. And so it's not just the experience of reading the book, but sort of participating in the full community.
Cool. Well, thanks. This has been really fun.
Yeah, indeed. Thanks for having me.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Synopsys and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The March-April issue of IEEE S&P Magazine features our interview with Bank of America CISO Craig Froelich. The issue is also devoted to hacking without humans and covers the DARPA Cyber Grand Challenge focused on both offense and defense. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.synopsys.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.